Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Riley, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is February 22nd, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today. The first one is A231071, Doe versus Meany et al. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that is permitted today. And let us know if there's any particular way we can reference you this morning. With that, counsel, whenever you are ready, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Michael Bryant. I represent Jane Doe in this case with the issues in today. In reviewing everything, I believe there's three issues of significance. One is the actual question of whether or not there was a negligent retention, which would be an independent tort against the defendant and wouldn't have any effect whatsoever as far as the release goes. Our position is that the court was wrong in their conclusions about the retention and got into fact-finding that should have been provided for with the jury, that the jury had the opportunity to do that. The Olseth, one of the defendants, admitted that they were aware of transference. And what transference is a person going to a psychotherapist and transferring their beliefs or they get support from the therapist beyond what a therapist should give. And the defendant, Meany, the perpetrator, took advantage of that, took advantage of a number of individuals, which, as the court found in its findings, was aware of. What happened was Olseth didn't look for it. She indicated she was aware of it, but they didn't have any policies in place in order to protect against it. Second, in her deposition, she indicated that the HIPAA prevented them from doing things as far as following up and taking place. And
what is your position that the law requires them to do?
Excuse me?
What is your position about what the law requires them to do?
Well, I think the law requires them to keep the public safe, that the Yonkers case requires that any risk to the public that's there, that they have a liability for that, or at least the jury should be able to hear about that and make a determination on that risk, on whether or not what they did was proper. They can argue we did everything we could, everything was right, but that's a fact issue for the jury. It's not an issue for the court.
And when does the duty arise? Just because you have engaged in some independent contractor or employment relationship with someone, that there's an expansive duty to keep the public safe?
Well, yes, under Yonkers, I believe there is a duty to keep the public safe. But if we go broader than that, then that gets into the second issue of whether or not this was an independent contractor or not.
I understand. But I'm wondering where the origin of this duty is, because I don't think any case could withstand a summary judgment motion given the way that you're framing what you believe the law to be.
That'd be great, but that's...
I understand that.
I think you need facts. I think you need to have something to happen. So I think I don't think it's that broad.
So is it the fact that you would need is what? That they were... The employer or the entity that's contracting with an individual is on notice?
She relied upon them in order to go there, to make the original hire. She went to Olseth and was given this person. She was billed through Olseth. That gets into all the factors with the independent contractor, that there was a stronger connection than simply just an independent contract separation. And so to begin with, the initial duty is when she goes to him, says, I'm coming to you for psychotherapy help, and they're aware of what can happen and what the dangers are, and they don't look for those dangers, and as a result, there is a tort that takes place. So I would submit that it starts with that first action when they choose to have someone come in and hire them in order to...
So, but here the record shows, I mean, both in the independent contractor agreement, that Meany was required to follow all laws, all requirements of the profession. And in addition, you know, there's a, you know, like employers do to help protect against sexual harassment claims. They offered a, you know, a complaint or feedback, and that could be done even confidentially. So what more in this setting was, are you arguing that respondent was required to do?
Well, we believe that they should have done a better background check to begin with, but beyond
but
that.
But that's not your claim.
Correct.
Now. You've got a negligent retention claim.
Correct.
So what would the law require them?
The law would require them to at least look. They're aware of the potential danger to at least look.
Look how? Like sit in on the sessions? Because I don't think that's allowed.
Well, I don't know as far as having to get to the point of where they'd actually have to sit in the sessions, but with the number of sessions that took place, with the number of people that he was abusing, there were questions there when he was meeting them outside of hours.
Is there any evidence in the record about other patients at this clinic who he was abusing? Or was that all related to the clinic where he went subsequently?
In the record, I think the court's findings were that he had abused other people, but I don't know that in the record there's anything particular to this particular clinic. I can't say that in a way that I'd say that's supported
okay,
by the record.
But I think the record is clear that nothing came out about his abusive behavior till after he had left the clinic.
Because they didn't look at all. Because they took the position that we're aware of this problem, as she said in her depo, we're aware of this problem. We didn't do anything to try to check on it or see if this is a problem.
But they're aware in general that there's transference, but not in particular with regard to the appellee defendant in this case.
Absolutely, but with no policy, it doesn't matter because they're not even looking. They're aware of it, and they're saying, yeah, we know this happens, but they don't have any policy in place to try to do something about it. In our position, they should at least have some policy, some way, in order to check on these things or be aware of these
things. So you started out talking about transference being a well-known thing that can happen in this kind of therapy. So then is it your position that all clinics should have a policy with regard to transference?
Absolutely. In this type of case, correct. In this type of, with this type of care with individuals, when you're dealing with vulnerable individuals in the same way that schools with teachers or other situations of dependence that you have to keep an eye on. You should have some policy in place. It shouldn't just be, we don't have to look. We know it's there. We know it's a problem, but we don't have to look for it.
When you say there's a duty to look, I'm not sure what that means. Look at what and look at and how?
Well, the number of meetings that they're having, when they're having the meetings, that's what I can think of off the top of my head.
And is there some legal authority that would support your position that the duty to look involves the things that you're saying that they should have looked at?
Well, I think Yonkers gives us that when you have the public at risk for these problems, I think that gives us the start to the duty. So I would submit that that case is where we can look to for some support as far as on this issue. I mean, at least if you look, or at least if you say you try, then at least you can say, well, at least we did that. We have some policy, even a minimal policy in place. But to have zero in place and to have this happen, I mean, it's inevitable that it's going to happen. It's a danger that's created that you're aware of.
Let me ask another question.
Sure.
Different tack.
Yeah.
So do you think that there's a difference between a patient's ability to select a person as opposed to when you go in for an emergency situation?
Oh, absolutely. I in an emergency situation, you have no choice. You're stuck with what you got. I mean, if something happens to you in Mexico, you're in Mexico and it happens, you know. So, yeah, I have no question that there's no difference. That I would grant in any circumstance. And there is case law when you look at it, that there are factors that come into that in play. I think that is, when you go to somebody and you ask for somebody and you're asking for a particular person, they send you to that person. I think that's the connection that's important in this case and significant in this case, but I grant that is the difference. Second issue is this issue of whether it's an independent contractor or whether or not there's more there. And the contract that was signed said independent contractor. There's no question about that. But when...
Could you address the issue of the Parenter release?
Oh, sure. That was the third thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the issue in the reading of the Larson case. Our position is the Larson case is doesn't have anything to do with the case we have here. It's additional coverage issues. Somebody was trying to get settlement with one coverage and then try to go after another coverage. And because of the way they did it, they gave away any rights that they had and weren't able to do that. So Larson doesn't apply. The footnotes, though, indicate that there is a possibility to keep a vicarious liability alive, and that's what we relied upon. It was clear when we were doing the Parenter release, everybody agreed that that's what it was. That was part of the stipulation for dismissal. Everybody agreed that's what we were doing, was we preserving this claim. No objection was made at that time. I guess I don't see it as being that direct. I think that there's an argument.
Maybe not, because the language in your release is pretty clear. Agrees to indemnify and to hold harmless the settling party from any and all claims in the nature of contribution or indemnification.
Well,
so
with the stipulation of dismissal they signed, I don't know that they could sign Meany. They could do that. I don't know that they could follow up and make that lawsuit against Meany. So I think
What might prevent respondent from suing Meany for contribution or indemnity if there is some on the vicarious liability claim?
I think the stipulation of dismissal they signed. I'd have to think about that some more. Yeah. Yeah, they did.
That was an agreement between Meany and the client, correct?
The retainer was, but the stipulation of dismissal was signed off by everybody. They were part of the case. Everybody signed off on that stipulation for dismissal.
Yeah, but your client would still be obligated to defend and indemnify.
If they could go ahead. I think they did as part of the stipulation for dismissal, but beyond that, I think at best they would get credit for what was paid by Meany's policy in that settlement. I don't think they'd be able to collect everything against Meany. They'd get maybe some proportion of it. Well, they would get credit for it is what they'd get. It wouldn't be a collection against the client. It would be credit for it. And then what would be different is what the difference is, would be our position based upon that footnote that you can still keep it alive. If they,
your client would wind up taking out of one pocket, you know, I don't understand how you avoid that result.
Okay, I think based on the stipulation for dismissal, and then beyond that, is at best they would get a credit for what was paid by Meany's policy. I don't think they would be able to collect the full amount. Meany's got no means to get anything from.
But your client is the backstop then.
If they receive the funds.
Okay, all right. We're belaboring. Okay, we just agree to disagree.
And yeah, so but our position is that based upon that the parent jerk release doesn't release everything altogether, and then our case should be able to continue. But
doesn't that mean that it's just not a parent jerk release? It's a different kind of release?
That's the hole in the law. You know, whether or not in the end this is going to end up being called some other kind of release, I don't know.
But
I don't think there's anything.
When you call it a parent jerk release in the document, don't we interpret it as what the parties are calling it, which is a parent jerk release?
Correct. I'd agree with that. Any other questions?
If we disagree with you about, I'm sorry about my voice,
about
the negligent retention claim, if we say it's not recognized, what happens to the rest of your lawsuit or your appeal?
It would still go back to the first question on the negligent retention, because that's an independent tort. So that has to be decided in and of itself. But if you disagree with me on the parent-jerk, then you disagree with me.
No, but on the negligent retention, if we disagree with you, is that the end of the appeal?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I lose. So that would be the result, just like the summary judgment motion. So any other questions?
Counsel, your time has expired. You'll have 5 minutes for
rebuttal.
Yeah,
thank you.
All right, thank you. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Pat O'Neill. I represent West End Consultation Group in this matter. There's two issues before the court. One, whether the district court erred in dismissing Doe's vicarious liability claim, and two, whether the district court erred in dismissing the negligent retention claim. Error is never presumed. Appellant has not demonstrated any error here, and the district court's summary judgment motion or order can be granted on any grounds, or sustained on any grounds. I'd like to start where we just left off, with the Perringer release issue and the circuity of obligation. A circuity of obligation arises where a plaintiff is required to indemnify the defendant for the plaintiff's own claim due to some pre-existing indemnity agreement or contract. A finding of circuity of obligation will defeat a plaintiff's claim as a matter of law. That's the Norwest Bank case 578 Northwest 2nd 772.
What do we make of the disclaimer, this sort of strange unicorn-ish disclaimer language that's part of the Perringer release?
I don't think this is the first time that there's been an attempt to carve out certain claims when you're executing a Perringer release. I'd direct the court to the Hoffman case, which is 411 Northwest 2nd, I believe 923. It had very similar language, except it didn't include the exact words vicarious liability. But in that case, the court determined that the intent of the parties can't prejudice a non-settling defendant's indemnification rights, and it doesn't change the indemnification law of Minnesota.
So you believe that that authority stands for the proposition that the parties cannot contract around Perringer, the law regarding indemnification that arises in the Perringer context?
The reason that very clear indemnification language is in that Perringer release in this case and is standard in Perringer releases is to recognize, you know, what's been the law for 40 years since Hoffman was decided, which is this release can't destroy existing indemnification rights. And it's really the only reason that a joint tortfeasor or an agent of a principal would settle on a Perringer basis. They need that assurance that they will be indemnified should any indemnification right arise.
It just seems odd to me that sophisticated entities are prohibited under Minnesota law from contracting around the way that they want to conduct business with each other, the way that they want to settle their claims. It seems counterintuitive to me.
I think the way to contract around it would be to not include that very specific and broad indemnification and contribution language. Doe agreed to satisfy any judgment against Meany for contribution or indemnity arising out of these claims. If that provision wasn't in there, I think maybe there'd be it'd be a different story.
Is it sort of like you can't have it both ways? You can't call it a Perringer release and then say it's not a Perringer release?
The label of the contract may not be dispositive. Not only is it labeled a Perringer release, it's also references both Perringer and Frye versus Snow Glove in the body of the agreement, and has that specific indemnification language. If the indemnification language wasn't there and we didn't call it a Perringer release and we didn't reference the case in full in the body of the agreement, maybe it wouldn't be a Perringer release. But I think at this point we're kind of like, if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, it's a Perringer release, and included that broad indemnification right, which created a circle. Judgment that Doe obtains against Meany is subject to both the common law contribution right that a principal would have against its agent and the contractual indemnification right that's included in the independent contractor agreement. That indemnification provision is broad, and it says arising out of any professional misconduct. That very clearly would apply to all the allegations in the complaint and, you know, Meany's misconduct with respect to Doe. The risks of a Perringer release are well known, and they're detailed in the Hoffman case. The risk is that you end up releasing any claim for vicarious liability against a non-settling party. I think that the Hoffman case should be dispositive, and that the district court correctly applied and interpreted the existing Perringer law when it found that the vicarious liability claims had to be dismissed. For that reason alone, we need not go down the route of independent contractor or apparent authority. But because the district court did, that would also be a very valid basis to affirm the grant of summary judgment.
Who is it in the record who drafted this release, the Perringer release and satisfaction? Because it seems like, you know, maybe if they just put in accept vicarious liability in that paragraph about contribution and indemnity, that, you know, the vicarious liability would still be there. So if we read the disclaimer paragraph, preserving the vicarious liability along with the next paragraph where it says everything is, you know, that Doe is agreeing to contribution and indemnification. I mean, that, so I guess my question is, do we know from the record who drafted the agreement?
I don't know if it's in the record or not, but I can represent to you that our office did not draft the settlement
okay.
agreement. Olseth and West End were not parties to that agreement.
Sure.
They didn't sign it. They didn't consent to it. I'd like to touch on briefly, the stipulation for dismissal was signed by our clients. The stipulation for dismissal stated that plaintiff's remaining action against West End is not affected by this dismissal. That's correct. It wasn't affected by the dismissal. It was affected by the settlement agreement, and it was affected by the broad indemnification rights in that settlement agreement. The idea that all the parties agreed to carve out the vicarious liability claim is simply not supported by the record. Again, West End was not a party to, did not participate in the drafting of, or consent to any preservation of the vicarious liability claim. Returning to the independent contractor issue, there's five factors for the independent contractor test. They're well known. The most important one is control. The district court here determined that it was clear that West End provided convenience, not control, to Mr. Meany. Mr. Meany selected his own clients. He set his own hours. He set his own schedule. He chose when to see those clients. He also chose whether he was going to see them at West End or somewhere else. He had no referral obligations to West End. West End had no referral obligations to him. He had no minimum revenue requirements for West End. And no part of the independent contractor agreement or the actual circumstances of his employment gave West End any ability to really enforce or control the manner in which Meany saw his patients.
Wouldn't there be a fact issue at least over apparent authority?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The Popovich case, as was discussed a little bit earlier, emergency medicine is far different than repeated psychiatric visits to a specific doctor.
But we're not necessarily limited to Popovich, are we?
I think the apparent authority, that's certainly how the parties argued it below and also how the district court addressed it. I think that Popovich is a relatively new doctrine that has never been extended outside the context of emergency medicine.
With hospitals, which are a different breed of animal than a office.
I agree.
And that's what this is an office, right? Where
I agree. I think emergency medicine and hospitals are completely different than psychiatric counseling or a psychiatric clinic where people schedule their own appointments, select their own doctors, and choose how often, when, and how to continue seeing that doctor. Emergency medicine is, a situation where you break your leg, you go to the hospital, take me to the closest hospital, tell me what needs to be done to me. That's not what happened here. The record's very clear that Ms. Doe conducted her own research. She went on Google. She viewed Mr. Meany's profile. She looked at his credentials. She looked at the location of his office and determined that, quote, he seemed fine, end quote, and chose to schedule her appointment with him because he was available the next day. This isn't a situation where she saw a West End billboard or has a West End insurance policy or that's the closest hospital to her. She did her own research, selected a specific doctor at this clinic, and scheduled her own appointment with her.
So should we apply just normal principles of negligence in deciding the negligent retention and the vicarious liability claim here as opposed to kind of this carve-out for hospitals?
I think so. There was a garden variety negligence claim in this case. It was dismissed in the first summary judgment order, and it was dismissed for a failure to comply with the expert review statute. I think that West End qualifies as a healthcare provider, so any kind of generalized negligence claim would come under the scope of that expert review statute and also the specific doctrines that we've been developing to recognize the unique character of healthcare providers as well.
Why? I mean, there's an expert, medical malpractice, there's an expert affidavit. You know, the statute provides an expert affidavit as required under, unless things are capable of understanding by a whatever. But why should we treat this situation any differently from any other negligent situation just because it involves psychiatric care?
I think part of it is the way that the complaint was pled. So the first cause of action is medical malpractice. The second one is negligence, follow-on negligence, and then negligent supervision, negligent hiring, et cetera. So the complaint sounds in medical malpractice. The district court at the first summary judgment hearing dismissed certain claims as falling under the expert review statute and sounding in medical malpractice. And the rest of these claims kind of have that same flavor. And also, again, West End qualifies as a healthcare provider under that expert review statute as
well. I mean, I'll push back on that a little bit. I don't necessarily think that the manner in which the business of the practice is conducted is something that sounds in medical malpractice or the negligent provision of care to a patient. If I understand the claim correctly, it was that your clients are essentially in charge of hiring personnel to fulfill obligations in the clinic, that they did not act as a reasonable employer should or is required to do under the law. And in any other business, they would be on the hook for a negligent retention claim. So I mean, separating that piece of this business out, I think Judge Siegel's question is, why shouldn't negligent retention be a recognized cause of action when we're dealing with the business end of a medical provider?
Okay, I'll answer that question in two ways. First, the Larson case tells us that the Minnesota Supreme Court does not recognize a tort for the negligent supervision of a healthcare provider. That's note four of the Larson case. Mr. Meany was a healthcare provider. Their negligent retention claim essentially boils down to a failure to supervise. You should have been watching the appointments in some way or doing more to monitor against transference. That's essentially a supervision claim. So for that reason, I think Larson would dispose of the claims. But even if we go back to a basic, generalized negligent retention situation, there's simply no evidence that there was any known dangerous proclivity of Mr. Meany at the time while he was employed there. We've heard reference about other abuse. That other abuse occurred at a different clinic in a different year. That other abuse led to a criminal conviction. That other abuse led to a separate lawsuit. This isn't the same case, and those facts aren't necessarily in the record here. All we have here is the fact that Mr. Meany passed a criminal background check. He passed a professional background check, some community vetting as well. No criminal record, no evidence of sexual misconduct in his prior activities. Combine that with no reports, no contemporaneous reports from any source, including Ms. Doe, of any sexual misconduct. And Doe herself admitted that she never reported him to the police, the medical board, West End itself, or anybody else who could do anything about it. The nature of this, as I think Judge Siegel referenced, was misconduct that occurred during a counseling session. No one else could be there. So without report from Ms. Doe, it was really not possible for them to be aware of that type of conduct. I'd just like to finish with the fact that
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Bryan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So in their argument, they basically want to read plaintiff's remaining action against defendants Olseth, West End Consulting Group, is not affected by this dismissal, and then to say, well, that really isn't really what it means. The dismissal is based upon the Perringer. That's how they sign off on it. That's how they're...
Was West End provided with a copy of the release?
Sure, that's why we're here. I mean, it's based upon their argument. It was based upon their argument that that we released everything by doing that. So that's the very basis of this appeal. So yeah, they were aware of that, but signing off on it, I don't see how that can mean anything different than what it says.
I mean, how and what's the effect on? What's the effect, given that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said you essentially cannot contract around the law underpinning a Perringer release?
Well, I disagree with the reading that we just heard on Hoffman. Hoffman doesn't say you can't still have the vicarious liability. It's silent as far as that issue. If it was clear, if it said it, you can't contract around vicarious liability the way that the defendant or the respondent say it does, then I'd agree. I can't. But that's not what it says. And the footnotes indicate that most likely that there is something out there and they should be able to go on. And our basis is they would get some credit for what was paid by Larson, or excuse me, by the perpetrator. But in the end, that doesn't extinguish our rights against them. Backing up further than that, the question is this negligent retention. And their argument is, well, that they're claiming that, well, we're saying they should have done more. They should have done something. They didn't do anything. Under the testimony that she gave us, she said she was aware of transforming, that it could take place, and they don't have a policy. It didn't even exist.
Did you put in any evidence of, you know, like she left appointments distraught, and the receptionist could see that, there's no other evidence other than that this happened when she was a patient of Meany at the clinic?
Well, the times when they met, the that was in the record, the excessive number of times that they met, that's what we base the reliance upon. But no, there's nothing specific like that that you left just brought.
Did you have any expert testimony that you submitted?
No, I don't think we need to do that. I think that's a fact issue a jury can determine. And with no policy,
a standard of care though?
It doesn't, with no policy, I don't think it matters. They don't even have a policy that takes into consideration anything to protect the patient.
I mean, he was obligated to follow the professional rules.
But he didn't. And they're aware of the possibility of that.
But that's the policy right there.
Well, if you create that policy for him, according to her testimony,
there
was...
Well, he was already obligated. I mean, as a lawyer, I don't know that a law firm gives me, you know, hands me another copy of the rules of professional responsibility. They tell me I'm obligated to follow that. And as a matter of fact, if I want to keep my license, I'm obligated to follow it. So I guess I'm not understanding where you're coming from on that argument.
Well, her response in the deposition is they had no policy whatsoever. And so what the court would be doing is creating some policy for them, saying, well, you had a policy of that you're supposed to follow the rules. They didn't follow the rules. They're aware of the danger of not following the rules. The idea that she went through them, their website, in order to find this person. He was held out by this person. They were on his cards. There's lots of connections that took place here that made this more than just a simple, distant, independent contractor. And based upon that, I'd submit that they had a duty to at least look. And if they'd looked, they would have found something. Now, if they looked and said, we didn't find anything even when we looked, or we at least did this minimal amount, I probably couldn't get beyond that. But they didn't. Her deposition, we didn't have anything in place, and claimed that they were stopped from doing anything about that. And I don't think we need to create a policy. I think that's, at best, a jury issue for a jury to decide, well, there's other things they could have done, or they can do it, but that's a jury issue, not a judicial issue. Any other questions?
It appears not, counsel.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments and your submissions. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion with